This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
And thieves to another priceless episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Don Cheadle's fake accent. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast.
Oi. Why you gotta be a Bonnie? Bonnie Rubble.
Trouble. He's such a wowza. Shut up, Don Cheadle. That's not your accent.
No. This movie has exactly one Avenger that stars in it, and you are not gonna shit on that Avenger.
It's weird to think that there's only, with the cast like this,
I know that's, that there's only one. I was watching this again last night going, these are everyone thought would be Avengers, and these guys aren't even in the DCU.
Technically, there's a Batman, kind of, but that's painful
kind
to talk
of.
About. You know what's not painful? Junk Food Cinema, because it's the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is only suicidal in the morning, and when they remove the jalapeno gravy from Jim's menu, I feel like we get a little twinge of that depression as well.
Shit, is it still there?
I don't know.
I need to check. I just got off my diet. I can literally go have it tonight.
Pause the podcast. We need someone to run over to Jim's and find out if that's still on the menu.
Do they have the Southwestern Benedict? That's all I need to know.
Southwestern Benedict Cumberbatch? It's just regular Benedict Cumberbatch with a cowboy hat? I would pay no small amount of money to see this happen.
It's Spicy Ben.
I can just imagine somebody bringing that to him as a possibility, and he's just, no, get out of my office. With a better British accent, you might argue, than Don Cheadle. Anyway, I am Brian, and I am joined, as per usual, as in all capers and cons, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce. Look, he and I go way, way back, and I owe him from the thing with the guy in the place, and I'll never forget it.
I'd never been to Belize.
Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
We are very, very excited because...
We're super excited, actually. We're kind of dorking the fuck out.
Yeah, we're giddy. We're a little giddy because this month is us gearing up, kind of like last month with the Denzel Washington, was all this elaborate ruse to tell you how excited we are that Equalizer 2 is coming out this year.
We're really fucking excited that Equalizer 2 is coming out.
I don't know. I didn't even tell you this, Cargo, but I actually wrote an article for Film School Rejects.
Oh, I've read it.
You read it?
I read it. It came up in my Google search because you dropped my name in it.
Correct.
And so my Google, and I'm like, oh, hey. And so I was like, I already know all of this. I'm reading it again because I'm fucking excited about Equalizer 2.
My favorite part of that article was coming up with fake sequels that Denzel was never in. And of course, the next one after Equalizer 2 will be the Threequalizer.
And then, you guys can find this on Film School Rejects.
You can, which is, again, the website that this podcast is brought to you by. But this month, we are gearing up and we're getting excited for the release of Ocean's 8.
Fuck yes, we are.
And I have already talked to a few people who don't seem excited about it, and I'm already getting that Ghostbusters vibe again, where it's just, I have to roll my eyes a little bit and just kind of move on. I personally, and I know Cargill, is very excited about Ocean's 8, which is basically Sandra Bullock playing, we haven't really identified if it's Danny Ocean's cousin or sister, but...
I heard it was his cousin.
Probably is a cousin.
So it's, the point is, it's the same universe as the Ocean's universe, so anything goes. There could be crazy cameos. There could be tie-ins with the other films, because, by the way, as we are about to talk about, these three films are a story. It is a trilogy. It is not just sequels. There is real development. There are real character arcs, and there is really stuff going on. And you cannot watch any of the sequel films independently without having seen the first one, because it is so fucking dense in terms of what it's doing with story and character. And we're going to get into why, but yes, we are super fucking stoked that, you know, getting another proper heist film.
Yes.
It's good to work with proper villains again.
Yes, absolutely true. So in so doing, and in our excitement, we've decided to dedicate the entire month of April to our favorite heist films. And we are going to do an episode this week on Ocean's 11. And then we're going to do an episode next week on Ocean's 13. And you might be saying to yourself, wait, well, hold on. You just said that it's a trilogy and all of these things go together. And
is it the number 12 in there somewhere?
Yeah. What happened? I know how to count.
Well, you guys know the rules. One of us is not a huge fan of 12. One of us really kind of is, but we settled and we decided we're going to do a special patron episode for 12 where Brian talks about all the reasons he really doesn't like 12. And I defend the movie against him weekly because, you know, he's not wrong. I just still love it.
Okay. Cargill, if people wanted to hear that episode, where could they go to become a patron of Junk Food
Cinema? Well, you could go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, where for just $1 an episode, you can get free content like bonus episodes, like us talking about 12, like our mailbags, like our junk food a la modes, where we talk about junk food that's in theaters or on Netflix right now.
Yes.
And by on Netflix, we mean the brand new stuff, not we're sifting through and going that's kind of the regular show. This is the stuff that just came out.
Netflix originals.
Yes. And you can find all that kind of material and much more, including our free full monthly episode where our deep dish. Where we go deep into our pile and talk about stuff that's a little harder to find. It's not always impossible to find, much to some people's chagrin, but it is harder to find. And I'm really excited about this month's because we're literally talking about one of my favorite movies of all time, easily my favorite movie of the last 10 years. And one many of you have heard me evangelize about for a decade now, and we're finally going to do an episode on it, and I am so excited.
Awesome. Thank you for setting that up. And if you would like to hear more of our regular episodes, you can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. Please rate and review us on iTunes if you go there. I really do appreciate reading those and seeing those 5-star reviews. You guys are amazing. Follow us on Twitter at junkfoodcinema, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And I just want to tease one more thing about this Ocean's 12 episode for patrons. There's a little bit of a redemption going on that I think you guys will be interested to hear as far as my feelings about Ocean's 12.
Oh.
Not a full redemption, but it's
a partial redemption.
Partial redemption.
Also, I think we can pimp this now. We've got a crossover episode.
Ooh, yes.
You have long heard us talk about our sister podcast, 80s All Over, done by Drew McWeeny, Scott Weinberg, and of course, the great Bobby Roberts as the editor and silent third member of that group. And they invited us to do a special crossover episode, so we just got done recording that. It's a lot of fun. It's going to be one of their bonus episodes. So go over, toss a couple shekels in their hat. If you are not a regular listener of 80s All Over and you do listen to us, you really should be, because it, along with It's the Movie Crips, is kind of the trifecta of this sweet spot. And we are all friends. We have all come up together and we all do our thing in a different way. And what they do at 80s All Over is kind of fantastic. Although they did just legally require us to never talk about an 80s movie again. So
yeah, we got a cease and desist, but that's only because Drew painted the word cease on his left fist and desist on his right and pummeled us.
I might have better lawyers, so we might be able to call bullshit on that. But listen to that episode to find out how that all goes down.
For sure. And I also want to go ahead and announce, because we've kind of been sitting on it, but I've gotten the green light to talk about the fact we're going to be at Denver Comic Con this summer.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
I am super excited to announce that we will, in fact, be at Denver Comic Con this summer, June 15th through the 17th.
And this is posting this week, right? So I'm going to be in Chattanooga this weekend. So if you're in Tennessee and you're a film lover and you're not at the Chattanooga Film Festival, you are missing the fuck out. It is going to be a bunch of us hardcore movie nerds, filmmakers, film critics, all hanging out, watching movies in a wonderful setting, surrounded by all the great food that is in Chattanooga. I've talked earlier about getting off my diet. It's because I knew I was going to Chattanooga and I was not going to be in a diet while in Chattanooga, because fuck that. Chattanooga is the Austin of the Deep South and I cannot wait. So any of you who are out there, if you see me, please grab me, say, Cargill, I'm a JFC fan. Or I have listened to your fucking show, asshole, something along those lines, so that we can chat about the fucking movies we're watching. There's several big surprises. I can't ruin them, but this, I'm fucking nerding out hard about what I get to do this weekend. I get to intro a movie and introduce somebody that is very special to my heart and to this show. And I will be able to talk about it later, but oh my God, you're going to be, the minute I say it, you're going to be, oh yeah. When I told Scott Derrickson what I was going to be doing this next weekend at Chattanooga, he said, Jesus Christ, that is the most Cargill shit ever, ever. And I told Jess and she goes, yeah, no, Scott's right. This is the most Cargill shit ever. So if you want to see the most Cargill shit ever, come to the Chattanooga Film Festival this weekend.
That is going to be the next t-shirt I launch in our stores. The most Cargill shit ever.
No, let's get past all the plugs. Let's get past all the business. Let's talk about Ocean's fucking 11.
It's never been done before. What's the target? When was the last time you were in Vegas?
You want to knock over a casino.
Three casinos?
The heist is impossible.
Casino security cannot be beaten. You're out of your minds.
Exactly.
You're a thief and a liar.
I only lied about being a thief.
You're gonna need a crew as nuts as you are.
Who do you got in mind?
Smash and grab job, huh?
Slightly more complicated than that.
We're set.
We're set.
We're set.
Do it already.
Why don't you check the batteries?
Congratulations, you're a dead man.
George Clooney, Matt Damon, Andy Garcia, Brad Pitt, and Julia Roberts.
Why do this?
Why not do it?
From the Academy Award-winning director of Traffic and Aaron Brockovich.
Because the house takes you, unless when that perfect hand comes along, you bet big, and then you take the house.
I've been practicing this speech.
A little bit. Did I rush it? Felt like I rushed
it. That was good. I liked it.
Ocean's 11.
You're either in or you're out.
And let's start by jumping in a time machine and going back to 2001, where sophomore in high school Brian saw this movie in theaters and lost his tiny little fucking mind over how cool this movie is.
So this is one of those movies that when you mention Ocean's 11, it feels like it just came out recently.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you guys that there is a line in this movie that will fuck with you when you think about it in context and how new you think this movie is. There is a moment in which Julia Roberts, a grown-ass woman, says, that's not mine. I don't have a cell phone.
I watched this recently and thought, the fuck does she mean she doesn't have a cell phone?
This is so long ago, it was still normal for grown-ass people to not own a cell phone.
Wow.
Think about that in context. Think about the fact that this is ostensibly a science fiction movie. There's technology in this movie that still doesn't exist. It is a science fiction heist movie, and the smartphone doesn't exist in any of the movies in the Ocean series. There were no smartphones by the time they wrapped up the Ocean series. Think about that for a second and then realize, holy shit, we are literally 3 years away from Ocean 11's 20th anniversary.
Damn.
That's how far out this is. And yet the movie is as fresh and cool and awesome as it was the day it came out. This is very important for me. I need to stress this. There's a reason why I've been wanting to do this episode for a while. There are three reviews in my life that I regret writing. And this is one of my very early reviews. It's in my first year of being a film critic. And I wrote a review in which I said, yeah, this is good. But, and I'm almost quoting here, it's a cotton candy movie. It tastes sweet on the tongue and then vanishes and you'll never think about this again. Ooh. And I have never been more wrong about a movie than I was saying that line, because I would then come to own this movie. It would be one of the early DVD purchases I'd have. I would watch it constantly in video stores that I worked at. I would come to learn it line by line. I would come to become close friends with people who also knew it line by line. I would come to go to a wedding in which I would be the minister at that wedding and quote the movie, and the bride and groom quoted it back to me and were thrilled that I included it. And our only regret was that I didn't put a second Ocean's 11 quote in the movie. I had thought about saying when the groom walked up, I hope you were the groom. And I was like, you know, that's a little, and he came to me later. He goes, the only thing I wish you'd done in that wedding was said, I hope you were the groom. And I was like, God damn it. This is why we're friends. Fuck. So yeah, this movie is very important to me now, and I've never been more wrong about it. So I am elated to heap some serious praise on what I think is the piece de resistance of modern fucking heist films.
That really segues nicely into something Steven Soderbergh, who is, you know, kind of like Tony Scott for you. I'm realizing Steven Soderbergh is one of my favorite directors that I didn't know was one of my favorite directors.
Yeah,
He sneaks up on you. Like, you start thinking about all the various movies he's made that you love. And
you think about the two or three that he made that you really don't like, and those hang in the back of your head. And then when you realize that those are the rare misfires and that you like or love pretty much everything else, it's like, oh, holy shit. I'm really holding these few misfires against this otherwise amazing director. And then that stuff just becomes the, oh yeah, but ignore that film, because when you get to the Ocean series and then you get to Logan Lucky, you'll realize that he's fucking amazing.
Well, and that came out of a conversation with my brother, who's doing a project right now where he, after seeing Isle of Dogs, watched every Wes Anderson movie over a weekend. And he liked that experience so much that now he's thinking of other directors to do that with. And I was making suggestions, and as I'm rolling through the IMDb catalog of these directors I'm suggesting, he was like, yeah, but that one, yeah, but that one. And I said to him, like, anytime you do this project and you watch every film made by a single director, there's going to be bad ones. I'm sorry. Like, no director bats 1,000.
There's only one director who has ever batted 1,000, because he only made one movie and it was a critical and box office failure that is now heralded as a
Night of the Hunter.
Night of the Hunter.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's entirely true. Yeah, if you make one movie and it's great, you bat 1,000. But most directors do neither of those things. And it made me realize about Soderbergh when I revisited Ocean's 11. He's one of those filmmakers for me. And he actually said of this movie, this film is an opportunity to give audiences pleasure from beginning to end, and that he wanted it to be a movie that you just surrender to without embarrassment and without regret. And if that isn't a filmmaker accidentally crafting a mantra for junk food cinema, I don't know what is.
No, that's the thing, is great, you know, movies aren't just movies are art. Movies are an art form. Movies can elevate us, but movies, we turn to movies a lot of the times to escape, and creating pure joyful escapism is an art all its own. And this is a perfect encapsulation of that. Like, everything this movie attempts, it nails, and it gets right. It is fast paced. It is sharply written. It is funnier on subsequent viewings than it is the first, because you're missing some of the banter and dialogue. It's like Monty Python and the Holy Grail that way. There's the more times you watch this, the more little subtle things you see. I just caught something new last night. I've seen this movie easily 50 times, and I never realized that that Ruben actually has covers of Time magazine with his face on it around his house. Like, I had never seen the Time magazine covers with Ruben on them. And it's clearly him. And it's like they've done that up, because this is a small little funny production detail that there's just so much. There's literally 11 guys in one shot. You're not looking at the Time magazine on the wall, but the time you do, you're like, ha, that's fucking hilarious.
And that's something, that's a good place to dive into this, is that, as we were kind of making jokes about, this is sort of the Infinity War of its day. Like, the number of marquee movie stars that are in this movie, like, literally, they had to accept less money than they normally do just to keep the budget down, because there were so many, and they all willingly did that so they could be in a movie together.
And they all became best friends, those that weren't best friends already, and kept doing these movies because it was an excuse to get to hang out together again.
Do a lot of gambling, live at the Bellagio, like... Fuck it, yeah, dude.
It was, because keep in mind, this is a remake, and it is a remake of a classic film that is only a classic film because of its cast, not because of the film itself. It's a film that was made by, you know, starring the Rat Pack. They wanted an excuse to hang out together and get paid, but they didn't want to fucking be there. Several of them demanded that the first take be the only take.
Yeah.
They just wanted to get back to drinking and get back to the craps table. And so they made this mediocre, enjoyable, junky movie that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing all these people in the same room at once.
Can I be real honest with you? I hate the original. I hate that fucking movie. And I love the Rat Pack. Like, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. are like epitomes of cool for me. And I still just cannot get into that fucking movie. And I think it's partially because of that, because it feels so stale. It feels so inert. And it feels like you said, nobody wanted to be there.
Yeah.
So this is one of the rare instances for me where a remake is better than the original.
I think the remake is infinitely better than the original. This is like the Thing level of remake where Agreed. It's like, it's not, you don't like the original has its historical significance, but when you say The Thing, you're not thinking of the Howard Hawks version. You're thinking of the Carpenter version. And when you say Ocean's 11, you're not thinking of the one of the Rat Pack. You're thinking of the one with the modern Rat Pack, you know, led by Clooney and Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt, by the way, or maybe it's not. No, Brad Pitt's production company is called
Plan B.
Plan B. Who? Somebody, though, does have a production company called Rat Pack. And I can't remember who it is.
Brett Ratner.
Is it really?
Yes. That's Rat Pack is Brett Ratner.
I'll just edit that right out of this episode.
Sounded really excited about Rat.
I didn't know that.
Say what you will, Ratner has produced a lot of cool shit.
Most recently, I saw it on the Lego Batman movie, which
he produced a bunch of the DCU stuff. He produced some really cool indie stuff. Like, if I'm not mistaken, I want to say he produced this really cool European female vampire film that I saw on Shudder that really entertained the fuck out of me one night.
It's unfortunate that he's a giant tool
that is a demonstrable fact. Like, the stories about him are legendary. There's a 20 years from now when we're still doing this fucking podcast, you're going to be doing Brett Ratner impressions instead of Joel Silver impressions because nobody's going to remember Joel Silver, and he's going to be the Joel Silver of this era. and you're going to do the cocaine bit, and it's not going to be wrong.
By that point, it may not be a bit with me. Let's just throw that out there.
And you're just going to have 20 years of Coke bloat, and but it's going to be Coca-Cola bloat. And. Yeah. Let's face it. Well done.
If you can't be a hero, be a Coke Zero. That's what I've said since day one of this podcast.
You've never said that on this podcast.
That is what I've said since day now of this podcast.
Since season 5 of this podcast.
God damn it, it's true.
We're in season 5, motherfucker.
Oh my God.
March. We missed our chance to do an anniversary episode. Because you know what we did? We were doing for our anniversary episodes?
Denzel Washington,
which is a perfect excuse.
Better than okay.
But okay.
Okay.
Stargrove. So Ocean's 11.
Right, this movie.
This movie that we're talking about, which is like, God, this movie is so perfect. This movie, okay, let's start with what your favorite joke from this movie is, because there's my favorite subtle joke and then my favorite, you know, joke from this movie. My favorite subtle joke from this movie, because this movie is just so sharp. The subtlest joke in this movie that I love is at the beginning, they're walking out of this club in Los Angeles. All these fans are freaking out.
Oh my God, yes!
Fucking Clooney and Brad Pitt walk through unnoticed, and everybody's freaking out over Topher Grace.
And
it's intentional as fuck. Like, they thought, wouldn't this be funny?
I pointed that moment out to my wife as we were watching it. I was like, okay, Clooney and Pitt just walk by, no one cares. They're all over Topher's nuts.
It's Topher Grace.
Oh man.
And my actual favorite joke is also tied into that, because I just lost 5 years of my life in jail, and you're cold decking Teen Beat cover boys.
Yeah.
And then he just comes back later. He's like, when they're talking about it, he's like, you rehearsed that speech, didn't you? Yeah, did I rush? No, I thought it was good.
Teen Beat thing was harsh.
Teen Beat thing was harsh is my favorite joke in the movie, because it's just like, you feel that pain, and it sets up what is going to be a really amazing character arc between these two guys are real best friends. And for the first movie, they spend kicking each other in the nuts. And from that point on, every conversation, it changes. And by the time you get to the third movie, and we'll talk about this in next week's episode, their relationship has evolved. And every time we meet them, it has become something else. And every movie, these two guys, their relationship goes deeper and deeper. And it's very subtle how they do it. But here, it's two friends sparring. And that sparring sets up the moments where they actually spar in front of the guys when they're conning their own team to get team members to do what they need to do. Particularly another one of the arcs, a thing you don't realize is an arc really until you get to the end of the third movie.
Linus.
Is Linus and the evolution of Linus and becoming a member, a real member of the community and of the team, and how that arc plays out in the long game is so fascinating, and how they toy with him here is hilarious.
And I think it's so important that we talk about these seeds that are sown in this movie that are going to pay off in 12 and in 13, because yes, Linus's arc is probably the best, because you don't know when you when he first meets Danny Ocean, and they're in that pub at it's Emmett's pub, like right across from fucking Emmett's Field in Chicago. And they're talking about, you know, Linus, and, you know, you come very, very highly recommended. Bobby Caldwell has a lot of nice things to say about you. And he goes, fathers are like that. And Clooney has this look on his face and he goes, oh, he didn't tell you?
Yeah, no, because he literally doesn't know that this guy, Bobby Caldwell, we will come to find out, is an expert grifter. He is just a fantastic grifter. And also, so is his wife.
That's the thing, is we learn that Linus comes from a family of grifters, and we learn about it piecemeal throughout the next two movies.
And that he's constantly trying to prove himself because he can never pull himself out of the shadow of his parents. And then his parents, over the course of movies, have to come in and save his bacon. And that is an embarrassment to him. And Linus is a character that is very much steeped in his own embarrassment and his own need to prove himself. He is, if you will, the Brian Salisbury of the series.
I don't think I will. I also don't think I won't. So there we have it.
But it's fascinating how we watch his evolution. So yeah, we meet him there. We see him on that very arty, that very arty sequence, on the train. Here, let's take a moment at the sidebar, if you would pour the drinks.
Yep, I'm on it.
One of the things I love about the Ocean's movies is that they are very much something that we're talking about right now. Ready Player One is out. We're having a big discussion in the film critic world over the celebration of nostalgia. These are nostalgia movies. These are essentially... these are nostalgia movies going back and just madly in love with the crime films of the 60s and the 70s. The entire series plays with this, and every movie has a different nostalgic opening credit sequence, and plays with music differently to evoke a different era, and plays with shot styles. Like in 12, you've got those crazy snap zooms that are very late 60s, early 70s, very French.
Yes, because he's making a different, we'll get there, but he's making a different type of movie in 12 than he was in 11.
Yeah, but he does that with all three. And in this one, this movie is the slickness of 60s and early 70s crime films. And he's borrowing these different styles and playing around with the visuals in a way that they did in these old films. And that first sequence where we meet Linus is unlike anything you will not only find in any other film of that era, but in any of the other Ocean's films. Like, it is just this almost non sequitur moment of music and stuttered film style. That plays out really well. At the time, I felt it was overly stylish, and I was fucking wrong. It was just the right kind of stylish. And that moment always works as the moment we're meeting a pivotal fucking character in this series. So it kind of has to stand out. Otherwise, that scene may not play, you know, shot in a normal way, it would not have the resonance that scene still has at this point of meeting one of the three big characters of the Ocean's 11 series, who is essentially, for those of you who have listened long enough, is the seventh samurai. Mm-hmm. He's the kid character. He's the one who hasn't proved themselves. Like, the six samurai are all respect each other, and the seventh one wants to prove that he's a seventh samurai. And every single Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven movie has that character. And that's who Linus is. Linus is that character.
Right.
And ultimately, Linus proves himself in a small way in this movie, and then overall throughout the series.
And you asked me about my favorite joke in the movie.
Yes.
Because
Wait, hold on. Stargrove! 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 going back 15 minutes.
It's crazy that we are getting off on tangents that are still about this movie, because that's how great we think this movie is, that we're getting off on this tangents movie, about the same movie.
This movie's flawless. Like, this is one of the perfect movies we're talking about.
It absolutely is. My favorite joke in the movie, because again, this dialogue is so damn
sharp.
Snappy. I love
so
it.
So sharp.
Their conversation where they're doing that scene that you have in every heist movie, where you run down the list of people in the crew and you give each of them an introductory moment. This movie does it so well that everyone is just casually awesome. Like, they don't even need to belabor any of the points of any of these people. It's like, who do we need? What? This guy. And then we see we are introduced in a quick clip of who these people are, right back to Danny and Rusty. And there's a great moment where Danny says, okay, Phil Turrentine. Rusty goes, dead. No shit. On the job? Skin cancer. Did you send flowers?
Dated his wife for a while. Bam!
I love it so much, because it's like, you get the sense of who these people are, and you don't believe for a second that they wouldn't be having these conversations. And so to run down, I mean, obviously we got Brad Pitt, we got George Clooney, we got Matt Damon. We also have Julia Roberts. I mean, and then I want to dive into the other members of the team aren't above the title card.
Well, I mean, come on. Andy Garcia, of course.
Andy Garcia, I have not been able to verify in this movie if it is actually Andy Garcia or a gorilla in an Andy Garcia suit, because the way that he walks and the way that he grumbles his lines in this movie, it's like his acting coach was Jane Goodall. Like, it really does feel like it might be a gorilla and not Andy Garcia.
Here's the beautiful thing. We'll get into this next week. We will spend more time about Andy Garcia in next week's episode, because Andy Garcia has an arc in this series.
Yep.
Like, he has a very real arc in this series, and I fucking love it. And how they take what they're given in the first movie. Like, really, Andy Garcia is an amazingly charismatic actor who's one of those guys who's really great at being likable when he's playing an unlikable character. That's one of the things hallmarks that he got away with, especially in the 90s and early. And so when he comes into this, he's acting against some of the most charismatic baller actors in Hollywood. Like, you got to out alpha some guys who are really good fucking alphas. Like, George Clooney is kind of the antithesis of what we talked about with Denzel Washington last month, where he's alpha as fuck, but he never needs to show that he's alpha. He's the guy who can sit back. He's like that Navy, like there's an old joke about the difference between Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, is that, you know, an Army Ranger will always tell you he's an Army Ranger and a Navy SEAL doesn't have to. That's George Clooney. Where you always know he's the alpha in the room, even though he doesn't smack anyone around. You've got Brad Pitt, very similar thing. You've got to act against this. So he fucking stiffens up and plays this kind of monstrous, ominous mobster.
Mm-hmm.
And does it so well that you really do fucking hate him and want to see him get ripped off.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about how Andy Garcia plays this, is there's never a moment of sympathy for this dude, because this dude is getting train fucked.
Oh yeah.
Throughout this entire movie. By the end, he's going to lose his girlfriend, who he seems legitimately in love with. He's going to be humiliated on the criminal scene. He's going to lose $160 million, and he's going to do it in a way where he's caught with his pants down, where he is tough talking and fails at every step of the way because he's been outthought.
Yeah.
And what we will learn about his character over the course of the movies is he's a smart guy. He's just not a really smart guy.
True story.
And so the way Andy Garcia plays him as gruff and unlikable here pays off so well throughout the series that at this point in rewatching it, I don't see it as a bug, but a feature. That is, like, it may have been at the time, like, what was he thinking? But over the course, in retrospect, I'm so glad he made the choices he made.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it works, because my wife, we were watching this movie and she goes, I feel like I would be afraid of Andy Garcia. Like, I would never want to meet him because I'd be very intimidated. So it got across for sure. Although the most unintentionally funny thing in this movie for me is still when Julia Roberts is in the gallery and she's like, do you like it? And he goes, I like that you like it, because he just sounds like such a troll. Like, it made me want him to have his own like Facebook account where if someone liked a post that he had, he could then like that they liked it, because it would be like the perfect joke.
I actually, again, this script is so sharp. I love that line. I don't find that line unintentionally funny. I find that line kind of revelatory in that here you have this guy that clearly does love this woman. He's like, you know, he wants to make her happy. No dick about art. He's just got too much fucking money. And he literally, the money isn't the point anymore.
Yeah.
It's like the money doesn't mean anything anymore. It's all about the control. It's all about the job. That's what he's obsessed with. He's obsessed with the job, and he's obsessed with his place in this particular universe and being the god of this universe. He doesn't care what he spends his money on. It's clearly expensive art. And he just, are you happy? Great. I don't care about this money. I don't care about the art. I care. You're what matters. And my control over you also matters. That's another subtle part about that moment. And so I love that piece of dialogue a lot.
That's fair. No, but let's talk
about
let's talk about the real star of this movie, who we've mentioned a couple times. Elliot Gould as Reuben in this movie.
By the way, I don't would take a big fucking drink, because the fact that we have not covered The Long Goodbye
yet, one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah, we both love this movie. What we need to cover this at some point, and we need to do it soon, because god damn it, Elliot Gould is a fucking legend. And to see Elliot Gould playing a fucking legend in this movie, to where all of these Hollywood big shots in the course of this film are, and over the course of the series, are always paying their dues to this guy. They're always paying him his respect, because he's fucking Reuben, man.
Oh, and in Ocean's 13, there is a running theme in that movie that underlines the legendary status of a person like Reuben that I absolutely love, and we'll get to that. But yeah, just seeing him in this movie and knowing that, you know, Soderbergh wanted somebody who was sort of a legend of the 70s, and a crew member suggested Elliot Gould, and he's like, that's perfect. And somebody get him on the phone.
He chews up the scenery in the best way in this movie.
He's like, so good in this movie that for 3 to 4 viewings, I didn't notice how terribly he's dressed.
Oh, God.
That's how good he is that it took me a while to go, wait, what the fuck is he wearing? Is that?
And they even make a great subtle joke about that in the third movie.
Yes, they do.
There's a whole thing to that. But the way he enunciates, you know, the way every scene Reuben is in, the minute he's talking, he fucking steals the scene. And then he has one of my favorite character exchanges in this movie, where he walks up to Linus, who's sitting by the pool.
Oh,
and
my,
he's like,
God, it's so good.
Yeah, he's like, so you're from Chicago.
You're Bobby Caldwell's kid.
Bobby Caldwell's kid. You're from Chicago. You like it there? Yeah. That's great, kid. Get in the fucking house.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
It's just like, look, yeah, no, he offered you a choice of whether to go in or not. It's not a fucking choice. Get in the fucking house.
By the way, he says to him, get in the goddamn house, and I'm only splitting that hair because it is important to note that Elliot Gould has the only F-bomb in this movie.
That is
Everybody
true.
Gets one in a PG-13
movie.
You get
one movie. In a PG-13 movie, and it is a great one.
And it's when he's basically talking about how insane it is to even, first of all, knowing enough actors, his first scene in this movie, he's eating. Do you know how fucking difficult it is to do a scene where you're eating?
Actually, yes.
Because okay, you do.
I learned this the hard way.
Right.
Let's go to the sidebar real quick.
Okay, back to
I learned this in Sinister at Over the Dinner.
Hold on, sidebar. I'll take a whiskey and a whiskey. Okay, thanks.
This is my particular brand of vodka.
Everybody sober? Close enough.
In Sinister, we have this dinner scene, and as we were sitting down to do the dinner scene, Ethan Hawke just kind of gives me this look. He's like, you know what, Cargill, I love this scene, but fuck you. And I'm like, what? And he's like, you don't know how hard this is? And I'm like, no, he's like, watch. And so I'm watching as, you know, one of the young kids is kind of plowing through the food because he's hungry. And Ethan Hawke is just looking at him going, no, this is not going to end well. And so, you know, and he's just like taking a bite every, you know, once a scene. And it's like 2 minutes before he takes a bite. And you suddenly realize, holy shit, the more takes they do, the more food. Oh, I didn't think this through. Yeah. This is my first movie. I have not thought about the practicality of this, which is going to make tonight very fun at the end because I've been dying to find out what the junk food pairing is.
Oh,
because,
you'll like it.
Because it's going to involve Rusty in some way.
You'll like it. But think about this scene for just a second. Not only is Ruben eating in his first scene in this movie, he's the only one eating in that scene. Rusty and Danny are standing there watching him eat.
Because they've already finished their Niçoise salad.
And he's fucking the whole, and it's like, somebody did not either. No. No, he knows. Elliot Gould knows entirely too well how difficult it is, and he doesn't fucking care. He is going apeshit on this salad the entire time, and still like finding room on the plate for giant chunks of scenery as he's just like gorging himself on it. It's amazing,
you guys. You gotta go up against Terry Benedict. You better goddamn know.
And then he, like, the whole history of the three, like, most successful robberies.
Oh, yeah.
I love those flashbacks. So good. And then, yeah, he's just that whole time eating and owning that fucking scene. And, oh, my God, he's a legend. He's a fucking legend.
Yeah, he totally, yeah. He's every time he's given a chance to talk, he steals the scene from actors 20, 30 years his junior. Like, and obliterates them in the best ways. It is fucking fantastic. That's what I love about that character moment. Here you have a really talented actor like Matt Damon, at the height of his powers, the height of his career, and he gets smacked in the face with Elliot Gould's dick like three times before getting a swat on the ass and sent into the house.
Which I have to believe,
holy shit,
is somehow velvet. I don't know, but I have to believe that Elliot Gould's dick is velvet. I don't
know. He fucking just rocks this fucking role. Okay,
and he has the one F-bomb, which at the end of that scene where he's like, I'm sure you can get out of the casino, but lest we forget, once you're out, you're still in the middle of the fucking desert. And it's so good that for a second, you forget this is a PG-13 movie.
Yeah.
And that they just dropped the one F-bomb. It's incredible. Also incredible in this movie, and I don't think it's enough credit, Bernie Mac.
Bernie Mac is amazing in this series. And yeah, he's got the most awkward scene in this movie, which is just one of the great like cons. Like, it's really interesting to see how he does this particular con because he's just trying to... It's not even his money. He's just trying to get the best deal on Vans possible, and he can't possibly just let it go at this. So he makes this guy super uncomfortable to the point that he offers him a deal just to get out of the room with him. And it's so great how he does it. I even went fragrance free for a whole year.
Yeah. Oh my God. No, I don't go for the traditional remedies. Plus I have a reaction to the camphor, and the guy's just like, let go of my hand, let go of my hand, let go of my hand.
and he gets him down from 18.5 to 16,000.
Yeah.
It's like,
which, okay, just
he
real,
just
real
saved
quick.
$5,000. He saved Ruben $5,000.
Here's the thing. Bernie Mac is so good in this movie that you don't even for a second question why the same heist team that can build an entire scale model of a vault cares about $5,000 being saved off the cost of the
Vans.
That's
that's what I love about that moment, because it's all about him and the grift.
Literally didn't even think of that until just this second, that it doesn't make any difference if they save $5,000 on those Vans.
No, it's that's the whole point of that scene is it's in his blood. Like, these guys, it's in their blood. They cannot go a single moment without doing something. They cannot escape it. And he cannot be the guy who gets taken by the van guy. He's got to take the van guy. And he does.
It's a movie that, as much as it is about a heist, it is an actor's playground, because this movie is about meat of the characters that is given to these actors to play with, like that scene. And then it's about the choices that they make as actors, like just little tiny things throughout the course of this. Like, the thing that I remember when I was growing up in this movie, between this movie and Rounders, every single weekend in college, I was playing Texas Hold'em poker all night with the guys on my floor. And it's like, the thing that I always remembered from this movie, and to this day I think about when I'm at a bar, is there's this scene where Rusty's sitting there with a glass of whiskey and he just puts it up to his cheek. It's the tiniest little thing where he's like just sitting at a bar and it's like his exasperated tick where he just puts the glass against his cheek. And I found myself like in my early 20s doing that, like unconsciously, just like, and I didn't even really know why, but there's so many little things throughout this movie where the actors are making these really small choices that are so interesting and add so much depth to these characters that you don't even really think about time.
It is a group of great actors all taking their moments and doing the most with them.
Hey, Junkions, Brian here. Now, I know what you're thinking. Brian, we love junk food cinema and all, but how many freaking double downs and devil dogs can one person eat? Okay, first of all, I don't like your tone or your use of alliteration. If you want to consume junky movies with your eyes, but consume healthy food with your mouth parts, it's time to try HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers your favorite step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. Look, I'm the last person anyone would accuse of being healthy, right? Okay, you agreed way too quickly. I don't know what your deal is, but I'm watching you, Alex. But trust me, HelloFresh gets you to try things you never think to cook on your own and enjoy eating outside of your comfort zone by offering a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly. It's convenient. Choose your delivery day when it works best for your busy schedule. It's affordable. They make it so easy to cook delicious, balanced dinners for less than $10 a meal. And you won't spend all night in the kitchen because recipes take around 30 minutes. The unfiltered wife and I had some little ears pasta, which I now realize sounds like something that would be very much enjoyed by Dolph Lundgren's character from Universal Soldier. As it turns out, it was delicious and so easy even a nilbog like me could figure it out. Want to try it for yourself? Of course you do. You'd be a fool just to take my word for it. Are you a fool?
Are you?
For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code STARGROVE. HelloFresh. Goodbye, Body by Burger King.
So let's get on to the next huge fucking legend that's in this movie.
Of course, we have to talk about Carl Reiner in this movie.
Okay, so Carl Reiner is a problem, and we're going to talk about that. I love Carl Reiner in these movies. Saul Bloom is an amazing character. He's ancient. He shouldn't still be in the game. He doesn't want to still be in the game, but he can't get out of the game. Like, he gives Rusty the whole rundown of, here's all the reasons I'm not coming. And then he goes, well, are you going to be at least be an adult about it and tell me what the scam is? And then he whispers it to him, and the look on his face, he's like, he can't say no. Like, he can't say no to this. Like, it's too good. It's too exciting. And even though he's sitting there popping fucking Alka-Seltzer like it's candy, or antacids because it's candy, he still has to do this thing. The problem is this, and I will point this out. This is the only tiniest little.
I'm wondering if we might have the same problem.
But insignificant flaw that this movie has. Saul is completely unimportant in this con. They actually only need 10 people for this thing. And they go for 11, and the 11th is Matt Damon, but they don't need Saul. What does Saul do? What's Saul's purpose in this movie?
He delivers the briefcase that has the explosives in it so that it gets into the vault.
Right. Why didn't they just put that in the cart with...
With Yen?
With Yen. Like really... The whole point is they're both getting there at the same time. Why aren't the explosives in with Yen? We don't need Saul to do this elaborate thing that actually helps tip Andy Garcia off a little bit because it serves no other purpose in the con.
Interesting. My slight problem with Saul's character is I don't understand his heart attack is problematic to me because it starts... beforehand, you see him sweating, you see him, it looks like he legitimately has a heart problem, and then you find out that a heart attack is part of the con, which is great, except that who were those early moments for then? Those moments where he's alone by himself and he's sweating and he's struggling to breathe, and it's like, okay, if that's really what's going on, it's weird that they would go, hey, let's work that into this. You should have a heart attack.
It's all tied in with, we see you, he has very similar expression, very similar thing going on when he's learning about the scam to begin with. He is very nervous. You see him when he's getting fitted with the suit. He's a little nervous. And then he goes all bravado on Danny.
If you ever ask me that question again, Daniel, you will not wake up the following morning.
It is literally just a misdirect. He is nervous as hell and is kind of freaking out before the con. He is worried about it going wrong. And then that forces us to think that maybe that heart attack is real. The first time we watch it,
oh, we're like,
holy shit, this has gone wrong. Because here's one of the important things. The Ocean's 11 is the perfect model of what a heist film is supposed to be. a perfect heist movie in terms of the genre of a heist movie doesn't just mean that things get stolen. The perfect heist movie is structured like this. The first act is finding out about the job and introducing our team. The second act is entirely about putting all the pieces in place to pull off the heist, setting up the heist, having a few hiccups along the way, solving those hiccups, and then going into the heist. The third act is the heist. And it's when everything starts going wrong. And things start going wrong and piling up, and how are we going to get out of it? And there are two types of heist films that diverge off of that. And you have your comedy and your tragedy. This is going all the way back to the Greeks. And your tragedy version of it is all of this stuff is going wrong, and it really is going wrong. And these characters have to suffer through it and ultimately, hopefully, at least get out alive or get out with the prize. Like that's one version. Then you have the Ocean's 11 version, the comedy version, and that's the most satisfying version. That's the one that these are the movies you return to time and again, where you find out that virtually everything that went wrong didn't go wrong. It went exactly as planned. And we're going to go back and we're going to show you how all of that, we just conned you. You thought it was going wrong. It all went to plan and ta-da. And it is masterful. And you're like, oh, that's so great. And so you find out that the heart attack is fake. You find out that they didn't blow the money in the vault. You find out that the money really isn't in the back of the van. You find out, and it's like, oh, this is exactly how it was supposed to go. And then you start going back and wondering which things actually went wrong. And that's the structure of a great heist movie. And so if you ever want to write a great heist movie, this is the model you want to follow. And this is the pace of how you do it. This is an expertly laid out heist movie, which is why both the 11th, 11 and 13 are great, and why 12 kind of falters a bit. But we'll talk about that in our sub episode.
So Carl Reiner to me growing up was always Alan Brady.
Oh, wait. Stargrove.
Yes, right. Stargrove. Where are my manners? He was always Alan Brady to me, who was the host of the show that Dick Van Dyke's character was writing for on The Dick Van Dyke Show. But this is also a guy who is responsible for directing movies like The Jerk and, inexplicably, Junk Food Cinema alum, Summer School.
Inexplicably? Summer School's fucking great. It's a great Carl Reiner movie.
You would watch that movie, like, legitimately, if you did not know Carl Reiner directed that movie.
I never knew Carl Reiner directed
exactly.
that movie.
Exactly. You would never look at that movie and rewatch. Say, Carl Reiner's type of movie right here. That's what I mean by inexplicably.
Except it's, what does it have? A bunch of really great characters, a story we care about, and it's a lot of fun and still funny 30 years later. Sounds like a Carl Reiner fucking movie to me.
That last one is because of Carl Reiner, not yes. the thing that attracted him to the project.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing is, I mean, some of his bits with Mel Brooks are fucking legendary. Like, yeah. The work Carl Reiner did in terms of comedy, he's a legend.
Yes.
Like, he really is a legend. Like, putting Carl Reiner and Elliot Gould in the same movie is two different legends. It's so great because Elliot Gould really is the George Clooney of the 70s.
Yes.
Like, that's who they are. Perfect analogous actors to put together. Carl Reiner, on the other hand, is this great zany fucking comedian, the likes of which you can only, like, maybe Bernie Mac is the only person on the 11 that are as funny and legendary as him. And even that I would have a struggle saying, because it's hard to find comedians that are as legendary as fucking Carl Reiner.
Isn't it crazy to think that the reason that they can't have everybody, if they were to do an Ocean's 14, is not because of Carl Reiner, but because of Bernie Mac? Like, yeah. Isn't that insane to think about?
It's really insane. It's really, really. I was just talking about someone online with this week. Like, I was at Comic-Con when Anton Yelchin died, and I had been hanging out with Walter Koenig, and I had a table almost immediate next to him, and I was with Koenig when he found out, when someone told us, and just his reaction was that wasn't supposed to happen. I wasn't supposed to outlive him. And that was just like this heartbreaking moment of holy shit. And when you think about that in terms of someone like Bernie Mac, who died so young and had so many movies left in him.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the only reason to even watch Soul Men is because it's his last film, and it's really just worth it to watch him and Sam Jackson kind of say motherfucker a lot. But it's like, man, you had so many more good movies in you, and you were taken so early, and,
yeah.
And God, he is so funny in all of them. And especially this movie,
yeah.
Like when he's just gnawing on his fingers when he's getting fired,
yeah.
And he's like, "You want me to get up on the table and dance for you? Want me to smile at you?"
Apparently, that was improvised.
You think?
Yeah.
That was such a Bernie Mac moment.
But the point that he puts at the exclamation of "Might as well call it White Jack" is. Like, I had to stand up and applaud the first time I saw this movie.
And it's
so good.
And it so sets up that perfect moment where Matt Damon goes, well, as you know, we at the NGC are very supportive of the hiring of color. And the way he stops right there, and Bernie Mac looks like he's about to whoop Matt Damon's ass.
It's so good.
It's such a great con moment. Man, it's so good. And yeah, oh yeah, and it breaks my heart to know that Bernie Mac is, you know, he's gone. Like,
yeah,
it's just like we were, you know, it's to, and to think of Carl Reiner saying, you know, you were supposed to speak at my funeral,
yeah.
Asshole.
Yeah, for sure. Also, just really quickly. Apart from Julia Roberts' line about not having a cell phone, the only other thing that will unfortunately date this movie is the fact that the Malloy brothers are played by Scott Kahn and Casey Affleck.
Which is... Well, I don't know that that really dates the movie.
No, but it does ensure that there's at least one thing you have to forgive about these movies in hindsight.
Okay, first of all, I strongly disagree. Casey Affleck... was, especially in this era, was just Ben Affleck's little brother and had done a couple of movies based upon being Ben Affleck's brother. It wasn't any good. Like, I remember writing about him very early on, and he was just one of those most detestable, nepotistic characters on the scene. Like, it was just like, this is a guy who literally wouldn't have a job if he didn't have a talented brother. And then... This is the thing, and this is what really kind of keyed a bunch of us into Soderbergh. Let's go back a few years earlier to another film with George Clooney, in which he took Jennifer Lopez, somebody who a lot of people really did not like as an actress, and just she was really just she wasn't great. And then she was in Out of Sight. Take a drink, junkies. We will be talking about Out of Sight because Out of Sight is a fucking great film. And he gets this amazing performance out of her where all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, she's a real actress. Like, from this moment on, you have at least done one great role, and we know that you've got it in you. He did the same thing with fucking Casey Affleck. And Casey Affleck, he gets a really genuinely funny performance out of, and he does it with Scott Kahn as well. The Malloy brothers are fucking funny.
Yeah. And I'm not talking about his performance. You know that, right? I'm talking about... the Brett Ratner kind of problem.
Oh, you
with
mean
Casey
the fallout with Casey Affleck? Well,
I'm talking about the Casey Affleck in real life now. That's what I'm talking. No, he's great in this movie. Don't get me wrong.
He would then go on to be a really talented actor, and we would be like, "Holy shit, where was this guy?" I honestly think it was Soderbergh that taught him how to act.
I 1,000% agree. I mean, you want to go back to Out of Sight for a second? That's the movie where Soderbergh, in the middle of a take, went, "George, what are you doing with your head?" Because this is the thing that people now don't even remember, but George Clooney had this weird fucking tick,
yeah.
Where he had a bouncy slinky head, mm-hmm. in every movie. It was the weird, it was like this smug thing he was doing where he'd always just like shake his head around.
Which works in the episode we did on George Clooney about his early career.
Yes.
Like when you watch him in Return of the Killer Tomatoes, he plays a perfect sleazy best friend with the head bounce.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was part of the reason he was very in the mid-90s, nobody thought he was gonna take. Like he like toned down the head bounce in Dusk Till Dawn. Like, he was really, like, oh, this is the first movie where we went, holy shit, this guy can fucking act. And then, of course, later that year, oh, this fucking eye candy Brad Pitt, holy shit, he could act. By the way, 1996, the year we learned our badasses were actually badasses. So, Old Man Cargill, that Old Man Cargill. So by the time he shows up in Out of Sight, Out of Sight was like, oh, wow, Clooney can do some shit. And so by the time we get, you know, just 2 years later to Ocean's 11, he's fucking George Clooney.
And in Out of Sight is where Soderbergh is like literally grabbing him by the head, like, stop it. And the entire screen persona of George Clooney changes from that point. So Soderbergh has a real way with actors.
And they would then become best friends and start a production company together.
True story. And in this movie, though, the Malloy brothers have some of my favorite bits where the two of them are just at each other all the time.
Let's have a discussion about the Malloy brothers, because there is an argument about the Malloy brothers that I've had with multiple people. What is their role on the crew?
They are, as I understand it, they are the red herrings. They are the guys who come in specifically to create distractions. They're described as drivers, but for my money, the only thing they drive in this movie is the van to San Diego, which is not even part of the plan originally.
They actually do other driving. However, they are also tech guys. Like, everybody always thinks as Livingston is the tech guy because he's the surveillance guy, but who creates the remote control device that drives the van? We never see who does that, but we do see Casey Affleck operating it, and we do see Casey Affleck using an RC remote control at the very beginning of the movie when we introduce it. We are led to believe that Casey Affleck set that up. And then in the third movie, Casey Affleck is the one who hacks into...
Does the cartwheel.
He hacks in and does the cartwheel. So... I think they're also tech guys. They're the drivers, and they're kind of like a catch-all, because whenever you need, it's what I find so fascinating about their characters. They are obnoxious and nobody really likes them, but they're so good at all the things that they do that you bring in the Malloy brothers, because of course you would.
Now, did you know that Luke Wilson and Owen Wilson were supposed to play the Malloy brothers, but they ended up leaving this to do Royal Tenenbaums? And also, Danny Glover turned down the role that went to Bernie Mac because of Royal Tenenbaums. This movie lost three people.
Wes Anderson is fucking knifing Steven Soderbergh in the back in Hollywood. Think about that, 2001. That, like, right there, where Wes Anderson is ganking all of these actors to make what many consider Anderson's best film. It is actually one of my least favorite of Anderson's films.
I agree 1000%, and I'm always by myself on an island when I say that.
We're on our own island. Like, the Royal Tenenbaums, just it's too mean. And what I love about Wes Anderson is I love Wes Anderson when he's big-hearted and he's being broad, and he clearly loves his characters and loves his story. And that is one of his period where he just felt like he was getting a little too mean.
I agree. And I think that might be why my favorite film of his is Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, yeah. Again, 1000%. Awesome. And I love everything he's done recently. Isle of Dogs, I think, is fantastic. The Wilsons would have brought something very different.
I'm going to get out of this car. I'm going to drop you like third period French. Oh, hi.
I mean,
it doesn't work. Oh, wow.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Terry Benedict. Wow. Wow. I'm not your pal, friend.
I'm not your friend, jackass.
I'm not your jackass. Wow. It's a very different movie. The thing is I love Scott Conn in these movies. I love Casey Affleck in this movie. I love them most in the third film down in Mexico, which we'll talk about next week.
Oh my fucking God. It's so good.
The thing is this series really loves its characters. It loves its actors. Don Cheadle. We have to talk about Cheadle.
There is so much to fucking talk about in this movie. Don Cheadle, in a role that was... And I think this is why he has the accent. This is my theory. Because
he's talked about it.
Oh, okay. So maybe I just don't pay enough attention. But my theory is that this role was supposed to be played by Ewan McGregor. and Ewan McGregor ended up not playing this role. And my theory was, when I found that out, like, that's why he's doing a British accent, is kind of just a nod to the fact that the role was supposed to be played by Ewan McGregor.
He wanted to do something different. He wanted to stand out. He wanted to do something that was very different, and he had the power to at the time because he was really hot, and he wanted to do something British, and he thought it'd be really funny if he just kept inventing Britishisms that didn't really exist.
Which is, you know, what's funny is Cockney slang, so much of it is not etched in stone. So much of Cockney slang is you take an expression or a word and you just come up with something that rhymes with it. So Cockney slang is actually pretty fluid. So it's funny to me to think that he's making it up, because he is, but at the same time, that makes it just as valid as any other Cockney slang. Because all you're doing with Cockney slang is whatever the actual expression is, say something that rhymes with it, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
So it's so fluid to begin with that it's hard to humorously make up Cockney slang, because so much of it is just made up to begin with.
And he does it so eloquently. But it was one of those things that apparently, if I remember correctly, Soderbergh was against at first, but then became very much a hallmark of his character.
Yeah.
And he's fucking great.
He really is great in that
and
movie.
I love that every single character in the team gets to do a con at some point and gets to play a character. And we never see Basher do that in the first two movies, and he finally gets to do that in the third movie. And when he finally does,
oh, he gets that moment. It's so good.
It's so, yeah. So
you tosses, you had one job to do.
Yeah, he's they just nosed the main frame. They nosed it right up.
Does anyone know what? And I love that Livingston's a guy's like, I'll explain later. I'll explain Livingston's later. Like, no, I get it. I'm totally with him on this. You guys, forget about it.
Yeah.
And speaking of creating language, well, this is one thing I really wanted to touch on.
Oh.
This movie creates language in a way that, you know, it creates a language for con artists and thieves that is referential. So basically, they're talking about different roles that people play within a team of grifters or heisters, and it's all referential, and they don't belabor the references, so it's up to the audience, really, to figure out what they're talking
about. And it sounds like they're talking about something real when they're literally just making this shit up. And they start getting more and more outlandish as the movies go on. By the time you get to the third film, there's literally references that are in jokes.
Yeah.
Like the best running joke in 13, which we'll talk more about next week, is called the Brody for a very real reason.
Yes, very real reason.
The Gilroy, which is, you know, as far as I know, based on Tony Gilroy, the writer director that is friends with Soderbergh and Clooney and a bunch of the team. You know, they're making jokes about their friends and fellow actors that they're just kind of throwing in there, and that you kind of have to subtly understand later, because this movie never puts big jokes in your face. They're all just left there for you to discover and enjoy as the movie is moving along on a rocket sled.
But the fun thing for me, and we'll talk about this with 13, so put a pin in it, is some of these references, some of these pieces of language are actually, they make total sense if you know what the reference is.
Yes.
And, you know, in this movie, it's a little more challenging for me. Like when Rusty says, you're looking at a Boski, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros, and a Leon Spinks, not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever. And you're just like, what could that mean? And it did have me kind of scratching my head a little bit and thinking, like, if we were going to pull a heist, would we say, like, we need a Hedwig, a Van Damme, and at least three Stargroves? Like, it all has to mean something, and it does. And when we get to 13, I feel like you know that it actually does mean something. And I just love that throughout this movie, they're talking, and like, it creates a texture to the world that they live in, that they all speak that language. They all know exactly what it is they're talking about.
We've got two bottle trucks and a final terror.
Man, we're going to need a Lance Henriksen, a Zoltan, and four Joel Silvers. I mean, a whole clan of McLeods, a Doc Holliday and a Doc Hollywood. We're going to need it all. Let's get them all in here.
McGruff from Clan McGruff.
Hey, do you want to pull off this Lincoln Hawk or not? Because otherwise Project X will not be a success. That's all I'm going to say. But that's one of my favorite running things throughout this movie, is that it really does make you feel like there is this whole other world.
He ordered a pizza and then went full Cobretti.
Oh, you never go full Cobretti. Are you out of your mind? You're going to end up with a raw deal if you do that. You can't do that. Damn it.
Raw deals when it comes a week earlier.
Oh, that's
Stargrove.
You ever hate us? Like, sometimes
all
I
the
just
time.
Hate us.
Like, I'm like, why do I do this podcast? I fucking hate this shit. I hate this guy. I hate reclining on my couch and drinking and talking about movies. This is awful.
It's terrible. Awful. We haven't even mentioned, by the way, you know, we've talked about a little bit of the look of this movie and the different cinematography tricks there. I never knew that Soderbergh shot this movie himself. Yeah. And he shot it himself under a pseudonym, which is really interesting. So the credited cinematographer on this movie is Peter Andrews, which is just a pseudonym for Steven Soderbergh. And then we need to talk about the 13th.
By the way, yeah. Soderbergh also famously goes down and will shoot B-Unit for Friends.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, Soderbergh famously went and just shot B-Unit for like a week or two on Hunger Games because his friend needed some stuff. And he was like, yeah, I'd love to come down and shoot some stuff for you. He just loves, the dude loves fucking making movies and will do, you know, like that's why when he retired, a bunch of us giggled because we're like, fuck you, Steven
Soderbergh.
Yeah,
I remember. I was like, that's bullshit.
Yeah, you're going to retire to paint. Yeah, that's going to last 6 to 18 months and then you're going to be bored. Then you're going to come back as a producer and then you're going to be, all right, I'm going to direct something again. Because of course you have to. It's in your fucking blood, asshole.
Wasn't Logan Lucky the movie he came back with? Because I thought it was after... what's the one with that was kind of like the different take on Psycho? It has Channing Tatum, it has Rooney Mara, has Jude Law, and it's anyway, that was the one that was, I think, supposed to be his last. And then all of a sudden he comes back with Logan Lucky, and it was like, you're back, and we love that you're back. But yeah, no, there was no way that was going to last. But we need to talk about the 12th and later 13th and later 14th member of this crew, the fucking score. The score in this movie is just as cool as the rest of the movie.
Oh, God, yes.
Which is really tough to do because the rest of this movie is, it is so cool that it's as if James Dean bought a Chillo from a Brookstone that was owned, from a mall that was owned by Frank Sinatra. It's that fucking cool. So much so, in fact, that when you watch other heist movies now, if you ever have that scene of like, we're going to tell you how we did it, it has music.
Oh, they rip off the boom.
Oh my God. It's just so bossa nova and it's so funky and it's so loungy. Like, you just imagine like going to a bar that still has like velvet seats and golden chandeliers and ordering an old fashioned and hearing the house band playing every piece of score that you hear in this movie. It's beautiful. It's like it's a score that was made to like be listened to on a vinyl record while you fucking make White Russians at home. Like, it's just everything about it. Just, I love it so much.
Yeah, and it was blistering for its day. Like, it was one of those things that was the coolest part about this movie when it came out was, holy shit, this movie sounds different than everything else. And you forget how important that is. You know, a lot of times, I mean, that was one of the big talks about Marvel movies for a long time, was that all the Marvel movies kind of sounded similar and didn't have a definitive sound until recently, when now they're really branching out and letting these, you know, turning loose these composers to make some crazy stuff. And then you have a movie like Black Panther, which just came out and had this amazing sound that didn't sound like any other Marvel movie. And that's what this was they put this together, and it was, I remember getting the soundtrack because even though I was like, yeah, the movie's good, but the soundtrack, oh my God. And of course, over the years, you know, it's just become just tied in, and all of these films have that particular sound.
Well, and it makes sense that David Holmes would go with a very sort of cocktail party-esque sound, because so much of the appeal of this movie has to be, as Soderbergh crafted it, these guys have to feel like they love getting together and hanging out and having a good time. And that's what their cons and their grifts have to feel like, is what they live for, you know, getting together and doing these jobs. So the soundtrack of this movie accomplished two things. One, a very brief period in the early 2000s where you couldn't not hear Elvis Presley's A little less conversation, a little more action, please. I remember I had the CD single of this fucking song. But it was like on the radio. It was in store. Like,
well, it had been recently remixed
by JXL, I think is what it was. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, it was huge. It was
to Las Vegas like Sinatra's New York, New York used to be. Like, you couldn't have a movie that had featured New York without at some point hearing the da 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 da, and that's what A Little Less Conversation was.
Which is funny because they intentionally eschewed Viva Las Vegas, which would have been a much more on-the-nose Elvis song about Vegas, and they went with this one, and it became huge. The other thing is my inability to not think about the Bellagio fountains whenever my infant son's crib soother plays Claire de Lune. Because it's like in every lullaby machine you can ever buy for a baby, and now when I hear it, I'm just like, I picture them slowly walking away from the Bellagio fountain one by one. It's beautiful. It's a great ending shot too. It's so perfect. It's like we all came together to do this thing and now it's done and we're just going to go our separate ways. But of course, 12 and 13 would have them crossing paths again. And frankly, they could make 10 more of them and I'd watch them every time.
Well, we're starting up the new series and we'll see what happens. There is nothing right now telling us that any of those other characters might not show up in that universe.
It's very true.
So, I mean, Ocean's 8, like people, like as you talked about, some folks are getting that whole Ghostbusters thing, and I there's a great essay out there on why Ghostbusters didn't work so well as a remake, but I feel that this is a perfect time for this movie. I'm really excited about it. It's a very interesting thing that can lead into something else. Like, what happens if several of the actors from the other Ocean's movies get thrown into the mix? Like, you know, I mean, I'm telling you, I'm going to lose my fucking mind if they go in and sit down in a room and fucking Ruben's sitting there.
Right.
Like, and, you know, and that is a possibility.
It really is.
Like, it's like, I don't know.
Linus has finally hit the point where he's established enough that he's like, the person they call in to do some very specific job.
Yeah.
He's the expert they get for something. That would be amazing.
Yeah. So it is a universe that we can could potentially see more of. And that by restarting the series but staying in the universe, we don't have to deal with the fact that where's Bernie Mac?
Yeah.
You know, the entirety of 13 is about the potentiality of losing one of your crew and then they did. And, I'm really excited to see where this goes, but I'm really excited that we've got another heist movie with great characters and some of the best actresses working fucking today. Like,
absolutely.
Why would you not want to watch that fucking movie? I don't know.
I'm super excited. And to bring this full circle before we get to the junk food pairing, we started the show with you talking about your review of the movie. I just want to let you know that you are in good company because Roger Ebert himself did not see a lot of staying power to this movie either and described it thusly. Serious pianists sometimes pound out a little honky-tonk just for fun. That's like what Steven Soderbergh is doing in Ocean's 11. As movie capers go, the specifics in Ocean's 11 are not necessarily state-of-the-art. I can think of more ingeniously executed plans, most recently in The Score. But then, this is not a movie about suspense, but about suavity. The Score, ladies and gentlemen, being described as a better heist movie than Ocean's 11, and you know, here we are almost 20 years later. What movie are we talking about?
Yeah,
it ain't The Score.
I do like The Score, but The Score is a very different film, and no, did not stand the test of time the way that that Ocean's 11 did. Ocean's 11 is just a part of cinema fabric now. It is at the end of this century. They're going to do the 100 best movies of the 21st century, and if that's not on the list, then something's fucked up. Because it is really going to be one of those films that we're going to be watching 30, 40 years from now, and they're still going to be funny and still going to be worthwhile, and we're going to be looking back going, man, George Clooney was a sexy bitch back then. Oh, look at how young Matt Damon is. Oh, my God. Oh, that's right. Carl Reiner was still around. Oh, my God. Like, it is going to be one of those great classic relics. It is very much like a modern Casablanca, where when it comes out, you know, it's got that, it's well received, but becomes such a fabric of the cinema landscape it is hard to remember a time when it didn't exist in the cinema universe, and is going to be something we can show to future generations who are going to love it.
Agreed.
And who are going to, you know, I have a feeling you're going to show this movie to your kids and they're going to flip the fuck out and then go, wait, there's four more of these.
Yeah.
Like that's just amazing. I guess, no, three more.
Well, by then, who knows?
Could be four, could be five. I hope it's so good that we get Ocean's 9 and then Ocean's 10 and then get to jump to Ocean's 14.
You know what? That's not going to happen until we get a Tall Swayze, a Wadsworth, a Freebie, Hold the Bean, and at least two Hitchers and a Miyagi.
You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more.
Here's this week's junk food pairing. Nachos, an espresso, cotton candy, sherbet, a lollipop, shrimp cocktail, a Red Bull, ice cream, jelly beans, and a burger.
I concur. I was actually thinking of that exact, of just like, let's put it all together. Like the whole point, if you're going to junk food pair with this movie, you just have to make sure you're eating whenever Rusty is.
Exactly. It's the drinking game, except it's an eating game in this
yes.
movie.
Oh, here's Rusty. Nacho time.
Nacho time. Because, and again, character moments and choices that the actors are making. This apparently was a choice that Brad Pitt made because he realized that this crew would be so busy all the time that they would probably never stop to eat. So they're always eating things on the go. So that's why you see him. And literally what I have just outlined for you in order is all of the junk food items consumed by Rusty throughout the course of the movie. I mean, he has a salad, some tea, a couple other healthy items, but everything I've just laid out for you in order is all the junk food he eats in this movie. He is constantly eating.
Yep.
And it's really funny because it took them several takes to get that scene right where Matt Damon introduces to Rusty the fact that Tess, Julia Roberts, is in the picture. And in that scene, he's eating shrimp. Apparently, they had to do so many takes that he consumed 40 shrimp before they finally got it. So he ate a lot of shrimp for that scene. It goes back to what we were talking about. You really got to slow down in case there's multiple takes with food.
Oh, this is the best part of my day.
Which is the best part of my day. By the way, I want to throw this out there because I mentioned it on Twitter. I put it out there as a poll question, and I got to give kudos to everybody for not cheating and going to IMDb, because the correct answer was not the one that was most chosen. So the question I put out there was, which junkie legend is a featured extra in Ocean's 11? Dick Miller, Stephen Lang, Henry Silva, or James Gandolfini? The answer is Henry Silva. He is one of the spectators at the boxing match because Henry Silva and Angie Dickinson both appeared in the original Ocean's 11.
Yes, they did.
And so it was amazing to me that I'm like, fucking Henry Silva. Guys, somebody comment on the fact that's Henry Silva and nobody's commenting on it. It was freaking me out. I had to go to IMDb like, no, that wasn't really right, because they would have said something. Sure as shit, there's Henry Silva.
Henry Silva.
Oh, it was so
just
great.
Just there for us movie geeks.
Just there for us. Speaking of being there for us, that is what junk food cinema is all about. Talking about the movies that you love when, I don't know, so other people probably have talked about Ocean's 11, but God damn it, we love it so much. If you would like to hear more of us loving up on movies, you can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can find Cargill at Chattanooga Film Fest this weekend. You can find us at Denver Comic Con, June 15th through the 17th. You can find us at Convergence in Minneapolis, July 5th through the 8th. We're going to be there too. So we're taking this shit on the road, yo.
We're going around. We'll be there.
We're getting around for sure. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MassWyrm, MassWyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And for Cargill, I'm Brian, signing off by reminding you, for God's sake, whatever you do, don't, under any circumstances...